the institutionalization of friendshoring, an era in which the most trusted country, not the cheapest one, gets chosen. The old common sense that once drove the global economy is changing. For a long time, the standard for supply chains was how cheaply something could be made, but now what matters more is how long a system can endure. As the age of efficiency gives way to the age of trust, supply chains are turning from corporate spreadsheets into blueprints for the international order.
Key message: the standard for supply chains is shifting from lowest cost to trust and resilience that can endure even in times of crisis. The pandemic, war, and export controls have made it clear that the cheapest system is not always the best one. Friendshoring is not simply about relocating production bases. It is a reordering of who to trade with and within which institutional sphere to procure. Supply chains have moved beyond being merely a market issue and have become a strategic space where diplomacy, security, and industrial policy operate together. Today's supply chain restructuring is being driven more powerfully by the tightening of invisible standards such as rules of origin, traceability, supply chain due diligence, and subsidy conditions than by factory relocation itself. In other words, competitiveness now depends not only on the price of a product, but also on the route and rules through which it has passed. In reality, supply chain restructuring looks less like simple block formation among allies and more like a distributed reorganization across multiple regions. To reduce dependence on any one country, companies are moving not toward a single destination, but toward securing multiple trusted pathways. Korea has major opportunities in strategic industries such as semiconductors, batteries and materials, parts and equipment. But it also stands in a position that demands the most sophisticated balancing strategy between the United States and China. The competition ahead will likely be determined not only by technological strength, but by how flexibly and credibly a country can design its supply chains.
The age of making things cheaply ends, and the age of not breaking begins. For a long time, the global economy moved according to a clear direction. Goods were made where production costs were low, moved along routes with minimal logistics costs, and supplied as quickly as possible to the largest markets. Companies stretched their supply chains as far as possible while also coordinating them with precision. Inventories were minimized, parts only had to arrive just in time, and factories moved wherever costs were lowest. This structure was astonishingly efficient. Consumers gained access to cheaper goods, companies enjoyed higher profits, and states regarded expanding trade as a natural engine of growth. Globalization seemed like an irreversible flow, yet that efficiency proved far easier to shake than many had assumed. The pandemic showed that when a single distant factory stopped, production lines across the world could stop with it. Port congestion and logistics disruptions revealed that supply chains were not simply lines, but lifelines made up of countless vulnerabilities. Then Russia's invasion of Ukraine made clear once again that energy, grain, transport, and insurance could all instantly become matters of geopolitics. When this was compounded by strategic competition between the United States and China, export controls, competition to secure strategic goods, and the expansion of industrial subsidies by major governments, both companies and states began fundamentally rethinking how they viewed supply chains. Now the question has changed. Is the cheapest supply chain really the best supply chain? If a system that looks highly efficient in normal times becomes the first to collapse in a crisis, then how much value does that efficiency really have? Companies can no longer calculate only production costs. They now have to calculate the costs of production disruptions when even one component is cut off, the trade frictions caused by diplomatic conflict, unexpected regulatory changes, technology controls, reputational damage, and customer losses resulting from shortages. The core of this change is not that efficiency has disappeared. Efficiency still matters. What matters is that it is no longer the only principle. Supply chains no longer seek only the fastest and cheapest path. Instead, they seek paths that will not break even in a crisis, that can recover after a shock, and that can withstand clashes between politics and institutions. The value standard of supply chains is shifting from cost to stability, from speed to durability, and from finely tuned optimization to structures that can endure. That is why today's supply chain restructuring is read not as a simple industrial trend, but as a shift of the age. The economy no longer runs on peacetime numbers alone. Total costs, including uncertainty and disruption, have begun to be reflected on the price tag. And at the center of that change sits the concept of friendshoring. Not allies, but countries you can keep trading with to the end, will remain. At first glance, the term friendshoring may sound like little more than a strategy of moving factories to allied countries. But its substance is far broader than that. It is not simply a matter of changing production locations. It is about who one trades with, under whose institutional system one procures, who is unlikely to cut off supply even in a crisis, and who will operate the rules in a predictable way. In other words, friendshoring is a concept that elevates relationships, rather than price, into a key standard of supply chains. What matters is that the friend, in this context, does not mean emotional closeness. In today's supply chains, a friend means a country likely to maintain trade even amid diplomatic conflict, to administer sanctions or export controls in a predictable manner, and not to abruptly overturn contracts and trade order. In other words, friendshoring is not about affinity, but about trustworthiness. Companies are no longer looking only for places with low production costs. They're looking for places where the rules will not suddenly collapse. Countries capable of maintaining at least a minimum level of predictability even amid political tension become more important partners. Past globalization believed that price and productivity mattered more than a trading partner's political system or diplomatic distance. There was strong optimism that markets could be separated from politics. But the changes of recent years have shown how fragile that belief was. Supply chains were never truly detached from politics. It was only that political costs had appeared low. Now those costs are visible, and neither companies nor states can afford to ignore them any longer. That is why friendshoring is, in effect, a new act of economic mapmaking. This map is not drawn simply by distance or logistics efficiency. It also reflects diplomatic relations, institutional stability, compatibility of norms, the risk of technology controls, the durability of the investment environment, and the consistency of law and administration. In other words, today's supply chains are not just routes of movement, but also maps of relationships, showing who can connect with whom and how deeply. This change alters the way companies make decisions. Procurement departments can no longer choose suppliers based only on price, and top executives can no longer treat geopolitics as an external variable. Diplomacy, security, regulation, and industrial policy have now entered the interior of production strategy. It is no longer enough to ask who can make things more cheaply. What matters just as much is who can stay with you to the very end. Friendshoring is the most symbolic term for explaining that shift. It is no longer market choice, but state rules that rewrite supply chains. What gives friendshoring its real force is that it no longer remains at the level of individual corporate judgment. This trend is now hardening into the form of government subsidies, tax incentives, investment screening, rules of origin, export controls, public procurement standards, and strategic industry support programs. In other words, friendshoring is becoming not just a strategy, but an institution. In the past, companies also considered political risk, but that remained, at most, a matter of internal risk management. They adjusted investment plans according to how unstable a region seemed, how uncertain a country felt, or how volatile a currency appeared. Now, things are different. Governments first define the nature of industries, judge which supply chains are vulnerable, decide which economic linkages with which countries should be strategically encouraged and which should be constrained. Companies move in response to those institutional signals. The order has reversed. In this process, supply chains are no longer an order that markets naturally produce. They are becoming strategic infrastructure designed and guided by states. In sectors such as semiconductors, batteries, strategic minerals, clean technology, and digital equipment, where industrial competitiveness and national security are intertwined, this trend is especially strong. Which country one invests in, with whom one signs long-term contracts, and which conditions must be met to gain access to subsidies and markets are all increasingly shaped by state policy. This institutionalization gives supply chains durability. Diplomatic rhetoric or temporary conflict may weaken over time, but standards embedded in law and administration do not disappear easily. Once rules of origin change, supply chain due diligence obligations are strengthened, and procurement standards for particular technologies and resources are written into institutions. Companies must redesign facilities and rewrite contract structures accordingly. And once re-engineered in this way, supply chains go on to reshape industrial maps for years. That is why today's supply chain reorganization is not simply relocation, but structural realignment. It is no longer just a matter of moving factories because wages rose in one country. The key questions are now which blocks rules one will enter, which institutional order one will be folded into, and whose standards and certifications one will comply with. Companies must now compete in markets while also surviving within institutions. In an era when supply chains become extensions of international politics, friendshoring is no longer a choice but an institutional environment. Before factories move, standards raise borders first. When many people think of supply chain restructuring, they first imagine factory relocation. Of course, the movement of production bases is a visible change. But the stronger force that actually reshapes the industrial map comes from changes in invisible rules. Rules of origin, traceability requirements, environmental and labor standards, supply chain due diligence obligations, customs procedures, technology standards, and eligibility conditions for subsidies all change the threshold of the market first, and companies then relocate production to fit those thresholds. In the past, the decisive factor was where something could be made most cheaply. But now it matters much more where a product came from, through what process it was produced, what supply chain it passed through, and what institutions and standards it satisfies. Even the same product can have different levels of market access depending on where it was refined, where final assembly took place, and whether environmental and labor standards were met. A product is no longer just an object. It is also a resume and sometimes even a kind of political identity card. This trend is especially pronounced in areas such as strategic minerals, batteries, semiconductors, and clean technology. It must be possible to explain who mined the material, who processed it, and under whose institutional system it moved. In the past, what mattered was bringing goods in cheaply. Now, what matters is being able to prove where they came from. Traceability, in other words, is not a mere administrative procedure but a document of trust. These invisible rules become new borders. If past borders took the form of tariffs and physical barriers, today's borders take the form of certification, data, reporting obligations, and regulatory standards. Borders have not become lower. They have simply become higher in a different form. It is no longer enough for companies merely to make products well. They must design supply chains that can pass the standards and build systems capable of proving that they do. In the end, today's supply chain competition is not simply a manufacturing competition. It is a competition of rules, a competition of institutions, and a competition between those who possess explainable supply chains and those who do not. Before factories move, standards move first. Before logistics networks are reorganized, documents, certifications, reporting, and traceability systems reshape the order of the market. The institutionalization of friendshoring is precisely the process through which these invisible borders redraw the real boundaries of the economy. If it is cheap but dangerous, then it is expensive. Resilience becomes the new source of profit. To reorganize supply chains around trust does not mean abandoning cost. Rather, it means beginning to calculate cost in a broader and more realistic way. Earlier supply chain calculations focused on production unit costs, logistics costs, delivery schedules, and inventory turnover. But now they must also take into account the probability of supply disruption, delays caused by diplomatic conflict, regulatory clashes, technology controls, production stoppages, and declines in customer trust. A choice that appears more expensive on the surface can begin to look cheaper over the long term. This change alters the very objective of the supply chain. In the past, the ideal model was one that minimized inventory and optimized delivery with precision. But after repeated crises, people have seen how easily a system that is too lean can collapse. A supply chain with no slack is efficient in normal times, but the most fragile in emergencies. Even a small shock can shake the entire chain, and the resulting losses can quickly exceed the costs that had once been saved. That is why what matters now is not how fast and precise a system is, but how unshaken it remains. Resilience is no longer a subsidiary item in emergency planning. It is a core competitive strength. Diversifying suppliers, holding a certain level of inventory, dispersing some production capacity, and combining long-term contracts with strategic stockpiles might once have looked inefficient. Now they are interpreted as investments that reduce risk. Of course, there is a price to pay. Diversifying supply chains can raise unit costs, management systems become more complicated, and the administrative burden of certification, reporting, and traceability also grows. This change can weigh far more heavily on small and medium-sized firms in particular. Large companies have the resources and organizational capacity to redesign supply chains, but smaller firms may become exhausted more easily under expanding standards and procedures. A system designed to strengthen trust can, if handled poorly, become a higher barrier for smaller firms. Even so, this trend will be difficult to reverse. The reason is simple. Today's world has become one in which crisis conditions must be assumed more frequently than peacetime conditions. In an era when uncertainty is no longer a temporary exception but a constant, a supply chain that maximizes only short-term efficiency can actually become the most expensive structure of all. Price is no longer the whole story of supply chains. Even if something is cheap, if the risks are too great, then it is expensive in the end. Resilience is no longer a form of insurance. It is a new source of profit. The world will not split in two. It will divide more subtly and connect more complexly. When friendshoring first began to rise in prominence, many imagined that the global economy would soon split neatly into two or three camps. Allied countries would build supply chains only among themselves, while competing blocs would construct separate systems. It was a simple picture of block formation. But reality is not so linear. In practice, companies are moving not toward concentrating all production and procurement within a single camp, but toward distributing functions across multiple regions. The reason is clear. If overdependence on a particular country is dangerous, then overdependence on a particular ally can also create another kind of danger. If the point of supply chain restructuring is to reduce risk, then it is not enough simply to shift from one axis to another. The realistic solution companies choose is diversification, not simple relocation. Procurement from one region, processing in another, assembly in yet another, and final supply near the target market becomes a more common pattern. That is why today's supply chain restructuring cannot be explained in a single sentence such as it moves from here to there. North America and Mexico, Southeast Asia and India, Eastern Europe and the Middle East, and parts of Latin America are all drawing attention at the same time for this very reason. Companies are not looking for one perfect substitute. They are combining several routes that are good enough. The future supply chain is therefore becoming less like a single chain and more like a multi-branch circuit. This reality reveals the essence of friendshoring more accurately. It is closer to selective connection than complete closure. It is not openness available unconditionally to everyone, but openness granted only to those who satisfy certain standards. Countries capable of meeting the requirements of rules, institutions, trust, and traceability can enter these new networks, while those that cannot are gradually pushed outward. Supply chains are not closing. They are becoming structures of conditional connection. In this structure, the value of the middle ground increases. Even countries that are not fully central powers can become important hubs if they can connect to multiple regions and possess logistics, institutions, labor, and an attractive investment environment. In the end, the world will not simply divide into two. It will divide more subtly while connecting more intricately. A multi-layered structure, one that cannot be explained by simple block formation, is taking shape. Friendshoring is the name of that change, but its actual form is a more sophisticated kind of diversification. The countries that rise now are not those offering factories, but those offering order. When supply chains are reorganized, new production hubs naturally emerge. But it is an outdated interpretation to explain today's beneficiaries solely in terms of cheap labor. Companies no longer look only for low wages. They increasingly consider institutional predictability, customs stability, logistics infrastructure, legal dispute resolution, industrial cluster density, skilled labor, the stability of external relations, and the ability to respond to standards. In other words, today's competition is becoming less about price and more about order. Mexico's rise is not explained only by geographic proximity to the U.S. market. Vietnam's frequent appearance as a beneficiary of supply chain restructuring is not simply because wages there are low, nor is India explained solely by its massive market size. Each of these countries is combining strengths such as logistics access, the growth of production clusters, institutional reform, connectivity to major markets, strategic neutrality, or strategic partnerships in order to position itself as a new hub. This shift completely changes the nature of competition for investment. In the past, tax breaks, cheap labor, abundant industrial land, and low-cost electricity were the main weapons. But in the future, the reliability of law and administration, trade networks, the capacity to meet traceability requirements, digital document handling, certification systems, and the ability to comply with environmental standards are likely to matter much more. Countries can no longer attract investment merely by saying, "You can produce cheaply here." They must now send the signal, "You can stay here safely for the long term." In the end, the countries now rising are not merely factory states. They are countries trusted to play specific roles within global supply chains. That trust does not emerge overnight. It must be built through long-term policy consistency, administrative effectiveness, industrial infrastructure, trade strategy, and diplomatic relationships. In the age of friendshoring, states are no longer just entities that export goods. They must also prove that they themselves are trustworthy industrial platforms. For that reason, competition among states will become far more difficult in the future. Low wages can eventually be matched by others, but institutional trust is not easily replicated. The benefits of supply chain restructuring are more likely to stay with countries that possess order. The power to attract factories will increasingly come not from price, but from a trustworthy operating environment. Strategic minerals and advanced technology, the real front line of supply chain conflict. The area in which today's supply chain restructuring appears most sharply is the realm of strategic minerals and advanced technology. Industries such as semiconductors, batteries, electric vehicles, renewable energy equipment, AI infrastructure, data centers, defense, and aerospace may look different on the surface, but in reality, they all depend deeply on a limited set of key resources, components, and equipment. The problem is that these resources, processes, refining stages, and manufacturing capabilities are heavily concentrated in a small number of countries or regions. In normal times, this concentration is efficient. In a crisis, it becomes vulnerability. Strategic minerals show that reality most clearly. Resources such as lithium, nickel, cobalt, graphite, and rare earths are essential to the energy transition and advanced manufacturing, but production and processing are highly concentrated in specific regions. No matter how advanced the factory or how sophisticated the technology, if the supply of critical inputs is cut off, the entire industry can be shaken. That is why, in strategic mineral supply chains, simple purchasing is not enough. Long-term contracts, investment, joint development, refining capacity, stockpiling, and traceability systems all become important at the same time. The same applies to advanced technology. Semiconductors are the brains of modern industry, and batteries are the heart of mobility and energy storage. Data center equipment and AI infrastructure are tied directly to digital sovereignty. In such fields, it matters not only where technology is developed, but also with whom supply chains are shared. Technology is increasingly the product of cross-border collaboration, yet the supply chains that sustain it are being placed under ever stricter political management. That is why competition in strategic minerals and advanced technology goes beyond ordinary industrial rivalry. What is unfolding here is closer to a new form of supply chain war. The weapons are not gunfire and shells, but subsidies, export controls, investment screening, long-term contracts, designation of strategic projects, and the race to set standards. What matters is no longer only who can produce most cheaply, but who can maintain stable connections most reliably. This is also the front line where the institutionalization of friendshoring appears most clearly. Who is designated as a strategic project, who gains the qualification to access a market, and who becomes the target of long-term investment and cooperation are no longer determined by market logic alone. The future of supply chains is being decided where trust and security, diplomacy and industrial policy move as one body. And it is precisely in this domain that the strengths and limits of each country are revealed most sharply. Korea could seize the opportunity or lose its balance. Korea stands in a highly important position in the midst of this great realignment. In semiconductors, batteries, automobiles, shipbuilding, defense, precision manufacturing, and materials, parts, and equipment, Korea is already one of the key pillars of the global supply chain. It is not merely an assembly country, but one with sophisticated intermediate goods, critical processes, and a skilled production ecosystem. The more supply chains are reorganized around trust and resilience, the more likely Korea is to emerge as an even more important strategic partner. Korea's strength lies especially in the interconnectedness of its industrial ecosystem rather than in a single product alone. The competitiveness that began in semiconductors extends into batteries and automotive electronics, materials and equipment, process management, and quality control. This is a major asset in an era of supply chain restructuring. Countries that support the middle of the chain with strength tend to remain important far longer than countries that excel only in final products. In that sense, Korea holds a strong set of cards. Yet at the same time, Korea is walking a very difficult tightrope. Strategic industry cooperation with the United States is becoming more important within the structure of the alliance, and ties with Europe are also expanding. But China remains a market of enormous significance to the Korean economy and an important part of its production and procurement networks. In export markets, component sourcing, industrial linkages, and investment flows, China's weight cannot be replaced overnight. Korea, in other words, is both a likely beneficiary of trust-centered supply chain restructuring and one of the countries most sensitive to the shocks that restructuring may produce. That is why Korea's task is not simply a matter of deciding which side to stand on. The more important question is how to design its position, how to diversify suppliers, how to expand resource cooperation, how to preserve both autonomy and openness in key industries, and how to reduce external shocks while maintaining market access. These become the core challenges. Such tasks cannot be solved by industrial policy alone. Diplomacy, trade, resource strategy, logistics, finance, standard setting, research and development, and localization strategies must move together. In the years ahead, Korea may gain greater opportunities at the center of supply chain realignment. But if it responds poorly, it could end up bearing only the costs while seeing its options narrowed. Technological capability alone no longer guarantees an advantage. What matters more is who can read institutional change more quickly, adjust production and procurement structures more flexibly, and design a more sophisticated balance between alliances and markets. Korea now stands at the very heart of global supply chain restructuring. That is both a major opportunity and a test of the highest difficulty. Trust is not morality, but arithmetic. The calculation method of supply chains is changing. To truly understand the era of friendshoring, one must look again at the word trust. To many people, trust sounds like an emotional term. It first evokes meanings such as belief, friendship, closeness, and cooperation. But in today's supply chains, trust does not belong to that register. It is a cold economic variable, one that actually changes cost structures. In the past, low unit costs were synonymous with competitiveness. Now there are too many losses that unit costs alone cannot explain. Supply disruptions, customs delays, sanction risks, restrictions on technology transfer, sudden regulatory changes, diplomatic clashes, reputational damage, and customer defections are not always visible in normal times, but once they occur, they generate enormous costs. In this context, trust becomes a mechanism for reducing those costs. More trustworthy institutions, more predictable administration, more stable external relations, and more durable partnerships may look expensive in ordinary times, but in a crisis, they become the most valuable assets of all. In other words, the global economy is finally beginning to reflect the cost of distrust on the price tag. When companies assess suppliers, they now evaluate not only production costs, but also how consistently a country sends signals, how unlikely sudden shocks are, and how stable an order it can provide. States, too, can no longer rely on tax cuts alone in the competition to attract investment. The key question now is how credible an institutional order they can offer. This change is likely to intensify further, as supply chains become not just production routes but components of international politics and industrial order. Trust will become an even more direct source of value across more industries. Even when the same product is made, who made it and through what route it arrived will matter increasingly. Supply chains will no longer be hidden behind products. They will become part of product value itself. Ultimately, the institutionalization of friendshoring is the process of moving trust from the realm of moral value into the structure of the economy. It is the act of turning an abstract form of confidence into a visible calculation. Once that happens, the global economy no longer moves by price alone. Who is more trustworthy increasingly determines who is more competitive. The supply chains of the future will ask not who makes things more cheaply, but who can endure to the end. It is increasingly unlikely that future global supply chains will return to a structure in which everything flows from a single center, as before. Instead, they are likely to become shorter, more digitized, more rules-based, and more functionally distributed across regions. In key industries, the pace of this shift may be even faster. That is because the purpose of supply chains is moving away from simply maximizing production and towards securing strategic autonomy and shock absorption capacity. In this process, states will intervene more actively. They will designate strategic industries, design subsidies, expand supply chain partnerships, and enter more deeply into competition over trade rules and technology standards. Companies, too, will no longer be able to treat geopolitics as an external variable. Geopolitics is now part of production strategy itself, and supply chains are no longer a secondary business function but a central architecture supporting the entire enterprise. Yet this future does not necessarily mean only closure and disconnection. In reality, companies seek not to depend on a single camp but to secure multiple routes, distribute functions across regions, and make supply chains more flexible. That means future supply chains are more likely to become selectively open rather than completely closed. They will not be freely open to everyone, but open only to those who meet certain criteria. That is why the companies and countries that survive in the future will not simply be those that produce cheaply. They will be those that shake less in times of crisis, absorb shocks, provide predictable order, and design multiple pathways. The standards of competition will expand beyond production cost to include institutional stability, diplomatic trust, capacity to respond to norms, traceability, and supply chain design capability. Ultimately, the supply chains of the next era will be a competition not only over who can move fastest, but also over who can endure the longest. The institutionalization of friendshoring is the name that symbolizes that era. There was a time when efficiency drove globalization upward. Now, a time is coming when trust is redesigning that globalization. Supply chains no longer move only goods. They move relations among states, the future of industries, and the direction of the international order itself.